Hello and welcome to a new chapter in Undivided, our next chapter. Welcome to the Undivided. I haven't named the studio. Maybe I should name the studio something. This is really exciting. You know, when we started Undivided 6-7 months ago, I had no idea what to expect. I quit my job. I launched the podcast. You guys, so many of you came along like, oh, we'll have your back, Brandy. We don't know if this is going to suck or not. And I mean, I was genuinely terrified. But to be able to get to this point, to be able after, you know, just a few months to be able to expand, to move into a studio, as you know, we're expanding the podcast as well, which is part of all of this. It's so exciting. And I think what's most exciting to me about it is that it shows that there are enough people who believe in this mission, who believe in the mission to give common sense a comeback, who don't feel like they're being fully served by the mainstream media in that regard, who believe the media is tearing us apart, politicians are tearing us apart, and we just need a little bit of common sense. And so we're going to try and continue to try to provide common sense to the narrative and hope to just expand this mission from here. So there will now be a podcast every Monday, Wednesday, Friday that drops at 5 p.m. The Wednesday podcast, although today is for everyone, we're celebrating today. So everyone has access to the podcast today. Usually Wednesday podcasts will be exclusive for subscribers. So if you're a subscriber, every single week, whether it's on Patreon or Locals, you'll get access to an exclusive podcast, just like this one, as a major thank you for helping to support this mission. A lot to get to today, a really busy first show. We're going to talk about the continued dismal prospects for Democrats in 2022 and this shocking upset in a Texas congressional race. It was a special election, a Republican won, and it does not bode well for Democrats if it's any indication of what's to come in the midterm elections ahead. We're going to discuss that with Democratic political consultant Sandeep Kashuk. We'll also talk a little bit about what's happening on the West Coast. Is there a change of tune in states like California, Oregon, and Washington state about trying to now be tougher on crime after so long not being tough on crime? So he's going to discuss that with us. I'm also going to talk about just the latest odd wrinkle in the police investigation in response to the school shooting in Uvalde, Texas. As you guys know, I've been critical of the police response. I think a lot of people have been critical of the police response there for obvious reasons. But as part of the investigation, they just took a really disturbing act to try to keep information from the public. As much as you know, I'm supportive of law enforcement. This one is really quite bizarre and concerning. But first, I want to talk today and start the show by talking a little bit about political extremism and political violence. It's been on our minds a lot lately, and I'll just be clear. I believe that political extremism, as you know, is a serious issue in America. I believe political violence, no matter who perpetrates it or for what cause, is a serious problem in America. We've had the January 6th committee hearings that have been going on. Yes, I believe January 6th was a case of political violence and political extremism. We had this case out of Coeur d'Alene, Idaho, where there were these right-wing extremists who showed up to a pride parade in Coeur d'Alene with, according to law enforcement, the intent to riot. They were all packed into the back of a U-Haul. That's where they were arrested. Police were tipped off to this. They were affiliated, according to police, with a group called the Patriot Front. So it seems clear, according to police, that they intended to carry out some sort of act of political violence. And then, of course, we had the attempted murder of Supreme Court Justice Brett Kavanaugh, which is absolutely horrifying. And it's an indication of what can happen when you have an issue like abortion, and that the climate in the media and in politics is so heated that it just inspires crazy people to do crazy things. And so we've had just a lot of instances of attempted political violence or political violence that's really been top of mind lately. And there was another potential case in Washington state, which is where we do this podcast out of. I want to show you this video. This is an attempted arson this week at the personal office of a Republican Washington state representative. So you see, there's two guys, one comes up, bashes in the window. I mean, very meekly, I should add. And then the other one comes in and throws a flare through it. Now, thankfully, that flare just hit solid ground. There was nothing to catch on fire, so no one was injured. The building wasn't burned down. But it certainly raises some questions about whether this building was targeted because of who owns it. Republican State Representative Andrew Barkas. It's a property management company. And the timing is very suspicious. Because a day before this attack happened, Representative Barkas's name was listed on what I think is just a really bullshit kind of study that was done, was listed as one of 29 lawmakers in Washington state with ties to far-right extremism. The analysis that bundled all these names across the country of Republican lawmakers together and put them on a list was done by Seattle-based nonprofit, the Institute for Research and Education on Human Rights. Their analysis was called Breaching the Mainstream, and it says that they went and tracked lawmakers and any ties they might have to far-right extremist groups. And a tie could be membership, but it could also be something like liking a Facebook post or being part of a Facebook group. And not only, you know, they have what I would consider, and most people consider, far-right extremism, like being a member of the Oath Keepers. And then all the way up to, you know, being part of a Facebook page that was pushing back against government mandates during the pandemic. That's their definition of far-right extremism. So 29 lawmakers in Washington state found themselves on this list. One of them was Republican State Representative Andrew Barkas. The next day, his office is the target of an attempted arson. And so one does have to wonder whether the two things are connected. Joining us is the man who was targeted by that, what I'll call an attempted arson, Washington State Representative Andrew Barkas. This happened on your birthday?
It did.
Oh my God.
Yes, my birthday was Monday, 54 years old. It was quite the birthday present, and you know, we'll talk more about it, but the more I think about it, I don't quite think it was coincidence that it was on my birthday. But yeah, it was a shock. I was actually in Nevada with some friends playing in a charity golf tournament that I do every year, and kind of a birthday weekend, and received a call at 8 o'clock in the morning to give me the news. And it just went from there. It's just been crazy.
So let's get a couple things out of the way. This is your personal business office. However, Correct. It also houses a political component. So talk about that.
Sure. This is my corporate office for my company, Hometown Property Management. We, you know, manage single family homes. I've been here in Olympia for 15 years, been in this community for almost 30, and in business here. So very well known, very known entity. I also lease an office space here in my building to the House Republican Organizing Committee. I'm the co-chair of that. That's our political arm of the House representatives in the Republican caucus. So that's where we, you know, manage our campaigns and fundraising and candidates and my seatmate, JT Wilcox. And then we have a staff member who is here permanently. And so it is our political office is located here.
Okay, let's just get a couple things out of the way, because we're going to talk about the potential, obviously, that this is politically motivated. I think that's the first thing that popped into my mind. I'm sure it's the first thing that popped into your mind. You doing any shady business dealings? You got any perturbed business partners who would do this?
No, Brandy, you know, I mean, anytime something like this happened, this has never happened to me. Yeah, I mean, ever. I mean, you go through the list, right? You start to think about it. Now, I'm in property management. It's not unusual to have tenants that don't like me and like my company. And, you know, we've had vandalism during the pandemic, the eviction moratorium. You know, my building was tagged. Rent strike, you know, rent control now, you know, things like that. I've had a window broken with a rock. We have quite a few of the Olympias homeless going through the alley. And, you know, I've had just petty stuff. Never anybody, you know, trying to burn my building down. And I can't think of a tenant to be that upset. And we racked our brains. Is anybody, anything recently? No. I mean, the worst thing that happens is tenants get upset. They go onto Google or Yelp and they write a bad review. You know, I mean, that's the extent of it. So I don't think this has anything to do with my business. I don't think it has really anything to do with the property management aspect. I think this is politically, you know, it has to be politically motivated because people know who I am. They know what I do. I've been all over the news, been with you, other people. They know my stands. And this, as you have been talking about, this is a highly charged political environment right now on so many levels.
Yeah. And I will say, I personally got a little bit nervous because I had posted a speech that I gave, the text of a speech I gave that you were there for. And I talked about you during the speech and I talked about you owning a property management company. I had just posted the text of it. Not that, I mean, I'm hoping that's not what set somebody off to say, oh, let's find his property management company and do something to it. But even I was like, gosh, did I put something out there that got him targeted? The Olympia Police Department is contending that the same two people who did this to your office went on to burglarize a antique store about 20 minutes later. And there's this suggestion floating around that perhaps the attempted arson on your office was a distraction to be able to get away with stealing from this antique shop. Is that a possibility?
There's always a possibility. I mean, people do weird things, but I've played this through my head now for the last 2 days. I even woke up this morning thinking more about it. When I drove into work, I drove by that antique store and I looked at the buildings on the way between there and my office. Brandy, there's no way that somebody, in my mind, is going to burn down, you know, a federal arson, right? Burn down a building to go rob an antique store. And even if that antique store had old, you know, gold jewelry and coins and things, between my building and there are number of what I would consider soft targets, easy targets, you know, a dumpster fire in the back of a grocery store. There's taverns, there's homeless camps, there's all sorts of things that could be used without creating additional risk for the perpetrators, but also creating a good distraction to get the fire department. We have homeless camp fires almost daily. I mean, they happen all the time, right? A couple blocks away from there is a homeless camp. It catches fire. The police, the fire department, everybody runs there. You do your burglary. Randy, this was planned. These people, if you've watched the video, they had a plan. One person, they knew that they had to break this window with a tool to break safety glass. The other guy comes up, throws a flare. No, I'm sorry. Maybe they are the same people. Maybe they decided, hey, let's do this and let's go rob this store because it's the reverse. You know, the burglary maybe is a distraction.
I tend to agree with you, Representative. It doesn't make sense to me if you want to get away with robbing an antique store to burn down an entire building. You don't know if somebody's inside. What if you kill somebody? Right. I'll also say, and I'm watching this video right now, there's a couple things that strike me about it, and let's just discuss it. My first thought when I just read that this had happened to you is, oh, it's like anarchists, right? People are going to be, I've seen anarchists go try to, you know, commit arson against police precincts, against the police union in Seattle. When you watch the video, they don't look like anarchists to me. You know, they're not young, wearing black. You've kind of got that look. These are like, first of all, the most uncoordinated arsonists I've ever seen. It looks like they've never committed a crime before. I mean, the guy that comes up is just bumbling, trying to hit the thing with the hammer. And then the other guy comes up. They're both wearing like dad shoes. They've got beer bellies. The other guy comes up and tries to throw a flare in. He's burning himself. And that also makes me question, okay, these don't look like criminal masterminds. When you watch it, what strikes you about the two men?
Well, we're looking at that video very carefully. And one of them, in particular, we're looking at because he does look like somebody that has been known to do these type of things.
You think so? But do these two guys look like they've ever done this before? I mean, look at that first guy swing the hammer.
Well, I think that some of the comments on the posts have been pretty funny about that, but it's not funny.
It's not funny.
You know, I think there's a couple things. Yeah, that's like 3/4-inch safety glass. I mean, we put in those because those windows have been broken. By law, you have to have certain glass by a door. It's tempered. You can't just break that with a tap. You have to really hit that hard. So yeah, he's struggling to hit that. He, you know, to break that. I mean, it's not an easy thing to do. The other guy, yeah, he's bumbling because, you know, when you light a flare, it's phosphorus. It goes off. You know, typically when you light it, you set it on the ground. You're not attempting to throw the thing. So it's going all over the place. So, you know, there's the adrenaline, there's all the things that are happening while they're trying to do this. I imagine that plays into it. Now, I don't know what a typical, you know, anarchist or criminal looks like. some of the people I saw in the peaceful protests that happened throughout our cities.
You can call it a riot on my show, Andrew.
Absolutely look like these guys. I mean, they've got their backpacks or skateboards and they're doing stuff and they're smashing windows. I mean, half of them don't have any clue what they're doing, right? So whether they've done this before or not, you can tell that it was absolutely premeditated. I mean, they had to know, Brandy, to have a tool to break that glass. They had to know, hey, this is safety glass. It's not just going to be a tap, shatter, or a hammer or whatever. You know, they had to have a route to get out of there. They cased the building. They planned this out. They looked at it. They knew there was a camera. They saw it up on the side, but they didn't know that there was one sitting in the window. The one up there is not, it's old. This one's the new one. So they were looking up there, kind of covering, but they, you know, turned towards the other camera. So I don't know. I mean, criminals are dumb, right? I mean, in general. I don't think, you know, if you have the intent to burn a building down, you're stupid,
right?
But yet you're not, you know, you're a criminal. You're like you said, you know, my son works for my company and he comes in on Mondays, usually around 5, to do the cleaning for a little extra cash, right? He could have gotten in early. He could have been down in the basement with his headphones on, you know, vacuuming or something, and the building burns down. I mean, who knows?
Yeah. And I'm so glad that you guys are okay, that everyone who works there is okay. And I don't disagree with you. It's obviously targeted. They have a plan. You've got the one guy comes up first, breaks the window. The other guy follows with the flare, and however uncoordinated they may seem, it's clearly intentional. I also agree with you that it doesn't make sense. You know, a flare could take forever to start a fire. Luckily, this fell on a hard surface and it didn't start one. It doesn't make sense as a distraction for me. So I hope that police get to the bottom of it. I'm assuming you've been in contact with them.
Yeah. And, you know, and I was thinking about that too, Brandy, that this, when you look at the guy drop the flare, he obviously recognizes as he's putting it through the broken glass, right? He obviously, when he watches it and he's like pauses because it hits the wrong way. There was two chairs and a little desk there, you know. It literally, when you look at the floor 4 inches to the right, that thing is aimed right at that desk and that chair, and those flares burn for 20 minutes, right? So it's going to light that, gone, building's gone.
Yeah.
So I think he pauses a little bit because like, damn, it hit the floor and they probably didn't know that it was tile. There was a rug there, just missed that rug too. So, you know, it is literally by the grace of God that it didn't do that. But to your other point, if I'm going to do that, I'm going to go up the street. I'm going to wait, right? I'm not going to immediately go up and rob this antique store 15 minutes later if I don't know that that building's fully engulfed. I'm going to wait to at least make sure that our job has been done and the building's on fire and there's smoke and everything else. Now I'm going to go because somebody's going to notice it. But at 4:15 in the morning, who's going to notice this? That building would have to be, my building would have to be fully engulfed, smoke, flames come out the ceiling before somebody driving by or whatever noticed it. That could be as long as 20, 30, 45 minutes before it's fully involved.
And to be clear, you guys did not know about this right away. So there was no police response to your building when the antique store was robbed?
No, we have an alarm system and there is a sensor. And for whatever reason, you know, great timing, right? The sensor did not pick up the glass shattering across the room and the flare coming in. It should have tripped the alarm, which would have, you know, they respond quickly. They call us, we get false alarms all the time. And we say, yes, send out a response. And then they go there and they check the building out. Obviously they would have seen a flare in there, right? And then called the appropriate people. That didn't happen. Now these guys don't know if I've got an alarm. They probably assume there are stickers on the windows and stuff. And if they've cased the building, they're probably thinking, okay, this is going to prompt a response so that, you know, somebody's going to be there, but a fire takes a bit to get going, you know?
Yeah.
So, all these things don't add up. I think from an Olympia PD standpoint, nothing better than to have a nice bow wrapped around distraction and antique store robbery, not politically motivated. Put the shoe on the other foot, Brandy. Say this is the Democrat headquarters, just a couple blocks down from here. And this happens. Are we doing that? Are we thinking that way? I don't think so. I think that there's that double standard, right? if this was on, you know, somebody attacking it, it would be all over right wing, extreme, you know, blah, 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 trying to burn down the Democrat committee office building down the street.
Yeah.
So I don't know.
Yeah. And look, I hope it's not politically motivated violence. I hope it's, I mean, it's still bad either way. But to have a narrative out there assuming that it's some sort of convoluted distraction is just odd to me. Representative, I want to run past you one other thing that has popped up and been circulated as a possibility. Your name made it on a list of 29 lawmakers in our state with, quote, ties to Facebook groups labeled as extremist. It was part of kind of a national look called Breaching the Mainstream when it was conducted by a Seattle-based nonprofit, Institute for Research and Education on Human Rights. And so basically, this list comes out. Axios published it June 13th and linked to this Breaching the Mainstream with your name somehow linked to extremism. I will say for the record, I've gotten to know you well over the years. For anyone to even suggest that you're somehow extremist is absolute bullshit and incredibly unfortunate that any news organization would just throw this out there. But this was shared by the chair of the Washington State Democratic Party. There has been a suggestion by your seatmate, the minority leader in the House, that perhaps this is the reason that you were targeted. Do you believe that's a possibility?
Certainly do. I've talked to those who pushed that out there in an article. I think it's, you know, especially the tweet by the head of the Democrats, Tina Paladossi, you know, ironic that the little mouse that she shows in her picture has a lit fuse on it. I thought that was bad timing on her part. But, you know, if you read her tweet, it incites exactly this type of thing. It's pushing it out to try to divide. Right? It's pushing out there to say, hey, here's a list of extreme Republicans, right-wing Republicans, you know, be aware of this, it's about time. And then she calls out one of my colleagues by name. And
Jim
what,
Walsh.
What good does that do? That puts it out there to the crazies to say, oh, we got to do something about these crazy right-wing guys, right? To your other point, yeah, I couldn't be further. As a matter of fact, I get more blame thrown on me from my own side that I'm too moderate, right?
You've been called a rhino before. I've seen you called a rhino many times.
Whatever. I like to do bipartisan. I like to do good work. It's what I'm elected to do. So, you know, this timing of this absolutely could feed into what's happening around our country. You've got the January 6th hearings on prime time, you know, every night in your living room, people are watching that. You've got the Supreme Court abortion stuff going on. You've got all this. Of course, all it takes is somebody to go, hey, we got to do something about these people. And that fits into a certain group that has been very active during the last couple of years, especially during the riots in Olympia, in Portland, in Seattle, that feed off of this type of stuff, right? And so the coincidence, the timing, everything kind of coming together puts it in that purview for me. I don't know all the details. I pray to God that it was some, you know, random, but it's not. I keep trying to tell myself that. So maybe I feel a little better today. I tell that to my staff that I had a staff meeting with who are scared shitless, you know, about, you know, wow, we work for this guy and, you know, people are trying to fire, you know, burn our building down. What the hell?
Yeah.
You know, and my family, you know, a little tense right now. I mean, it's like, you know, really? You're going to keep doing this? I mean,
the image you referenced comes from the Axios article. I'm assuming you're talking about the mouse with a little light lit at the end that the state Republican or the state Democratic Party chair tweeted out. You said you spoke. Did you speak to Lewis Cam, who wrote the article for Axios?
No, I spoke to Melissa Santos, who pushed it out there. And we talked yesterday and I really like Melissa. All the work that she's done, we've got a good relationship. She's always been very fair. And she was concerned, you know, I mean, there's a clarifying article coming out, I think, today. And we talked a lot about, you know, what, you know, cause I told her the same thing that you just said. I said, Melissa, come on. I mean, really me, you know, I mean, JT as a right wing, come on, you know, I mean, every caucus has a couple people in it that you would maybe say, yeah, but have you ever seen me at a rally or a protest or some, you know, no, But have I been supportive? Have I been outspoken against the governor's mandates? Absolutely. Have I been an anti-vaxxer? No. But I was upset when they fired 2,000 people. So I've been very vocal about that. So, and maybe I like to post here, like, the, whatever. It doesn't make me a radical. So we'll see what this article and how it clarifies. Tina did post another one because Caleb kind of called her out.
Good.
Then the governor actually, I was shocked. The governor actually tweeted condemning the incident. Hasn't called me. Nobody has really reached out and said, hey, we're sorry about that from the other side. Did have one text from a representative, sitting representative, a colleague that I work with a lot, is very concerned. So,
yeah, the governor, I'll just read what the governor said, because it was, I think, good that he came out right away and denounces. He said, such attempts at violence are abhorrent. We're thankful no one was hurt. Hopefully law enforcement is able to identify these individuals before they inflict any more harm. And that's what we need whenever there's, I mean, any violence, but particularly political violence. So good for the governor for coming out. Have you talked to Tina Podlodowski? Have you spoken to her about pushing out this narrative that you're extremist?
I think I've met her once in passing or something. I mean, she knows who I am. I mean, she knows I am her opposition. I chair, you know, the HROC, you know. I mean, we're going after it. They know what's up in this election. They know this is going to be the most influential election historic in 30 years. And they're desperate on multiple, platforms. But I've never talked to her, but she's thrown some things my way over the years in her Twitter fun.
Yeah, but she's smart enough to know that you're not extremist. So is Lewis Cam. So is Melissa Santos. I'm glad they're at least going to come out with something, because, you know, throwing this out there journalistically and it's basically giving people a target to say, click here to find all the people deemed extremist, when you have journalists who know that you're not extreme. Now, don't get me wrong. There are some people on that list who I would consider extremists, who I am genuinely concerned about. You're not one of them. And to suggest otherwise. But out of fairness, what are the... what is the group or the groups on Facebook that you belong or belong to that raised red flags?
I don't think I belong to any groups. I think the only thing that could come to mind is I may have liked a post by Timber Unity, when they did their log truck protests down in Oregon. I thought that was pretty cool. I liked the hairdressers when the 3,000 came to the Capitol and did their protests. You know, I think that's good. That's good. That's what we should be doing, you know, but is a bunch of log trucks right wing? No, I don't think so. You know, have they ever been involved? No. I don't like, or I'm not on any other of these sites. I just don't do it. I never have. I hate Facebook. I do it out of necessity. If you look at my Facebook posts, it's usually, hey, I'm doing this. It's fun. I'm camping, you know, pretty light. I've had some hard hitting stuff again. During the COVID, you know, I sued the governor. You know, there was things that went on. I was very upset about the way things have been handled by our government here in Washington State, as are many people. But that doesn't make me extreme. So I don't know where they're tying this together, but they obviously scrubbed. And who knows? Maybe I liked something from Jim Walsh or somebody else. And oh, that ties me to another member, you know. So, you know, same thing with JT. I mean, really? I mean, you know, he's everywhere. He's all over Twitter and Facebook. So there's a possibility that something cross paths, right? But again, I think my policy and my work as a legislator speaks volumes about who I am and how I work with everybody. Look at the bipartisan stuff I've done. Look at the things I've accomplished. You can't say that about a lot of the members in the House or the Senate.
Since you brought him up, the article in the study focuses on Jim Walsh, who I've met many times. Do you consider Jim Walsh to be on the extreme end of the Republican Party?
I don't think he's extreme. I think Jim is Jim reminds me of, and I want to say this nicely with that, because Jim is larger than life. He's a big personality, right? Smarter than smart. But sometimes that not so smart, because his big personality and his, you know, he's become a persona, right? He's become a personality. He's everywhere. He does all of his stuff. He's one of those guys. I'm not. You know, does he have aspirations for other things? Maybe. Maybe he's creating more of a platform. He'll poke the bear. He certainly will. I mean, he's not afraid of doing that. And he has more latitude because of his constituency, right? So who he represents. It is easier for him to do what he does. Jim's a great guy. I mean, I like Jim. I've served with him. He was one of my assistant rankings on transportation. Super smart. does a lot of good things, but he's also got himself in the hot water, you know, in the process, in the legislature. You know, they don't like him because he's very outspoken. And his very nature of how he speaks is big and bold and loud, right? He's a big guy, big voice, and I think he scares the other side.
Well, could he stand to scale it back a little bit?
Oh, of course. And everybody could. I mean, you know, I'm a diplomat. I think people would say that, right? There's a time and place for being, you know, like now, I'm pretty upset about what's been going on. I might come across a little bit more that way. But I can also finesse my speech. I can also bring it down 10 notches. I don't think everybody has that ability. And sometimes when you get I don't want to say labeled, but when you become that personality, you stick with that personality, right? And so, you know, when I'm hanging out with Jim Walsh, you know, and he's not that, he's calm. You've met him. He's very pleasant. He's very, you know, he's a guy to sit and have dinner and talk, and he's smart, you know. But then he can turn that on, and he gives the most fiery, passionate thing. I'm not that guy. My speeches, if you've seen, they're not fiery. They're poignant. They'll get to the point, but they're it's just different. It's a different manner. It's a style, right?
Well, Representative Andrew Barkus, I am glad you're okay. I'm glad your employees and your son are okay. I hope this doesn't turn out to be something politically motivated, but I also don't buy the narrative that's been put out there. And so I'm going to wait for actual factual information rather than assumptions. But keep us up to date, okay? And be safe.
I will. We're going to take some steps here, Brandy. We're doing some investigating on our own. We've got that person of interest that we're trying to get a little more details. There will be some more stuff forthcoming, I think, from our caucus. We're going to push this to really get the information out there so we can solve this. And I don't want this to happen to anybody else. This is just not a good thing. There's too many other good things that we need to be doing. So I need to get back to work and focus on bringing balance back to Washington State. That's my primary goal right now.
Yeah, good. And hopefully everybody else can just focus on bringing the temperature down and not
Absolutely.
Painting with a broad brush a bunch of people as political extremists, especially in this environment. So, Representative, thank you.
Thank you, Brandy. I appreciate it, as always.
Again, glad that everyone at that office is fine. The whole tie to, you know, the antique shop ripoff and all that being a cover, I don't know. I need more information, and you know, maybe further in the investigation we'll understand it. But look, I do have to take issue with something that came up in that conversation. I've been a political reporter in Washington State for 10 years. I know that Andrew Barkus isn't an extremist, nowhere close to it. He is what I would consider a moderate Republican. So for this group, the Institute for Research and Education on Human Rights, to just throw a bunch of people on that list because they might be tangentially tied to pushback over government mandates is so beyond the pale. But I think what's worse than that is the fact that you've got media outlets like Axios Seattle that have writers that have been political reporters in Washington State for a long time who just throw this out there like 29 lawmakers in Washington State deemed having ties to right-wing extremism. And they put in some throwaway line like Republicans are pushing back against the narrative. Look, if you're going to share and platform this study analysis as a journalist, you have to, one, know the potential ramifications of doing so. And two, you better do the due diligence to go through every freaking name on that list to make sure that they're actually, you know, part or belong to or have some significant tie to a group that is widely recognized as being extremist. That's not the case for Andrew Barkus. And to have journalists who know that still platform this analysis, to me, is really beyond the pale. And for the chair of the Washington State Democratic Party, Tina Podlodowski, and I'll invite her on the show, for her to push this out there, knowing full well that there are not 29 lawmakers in Washington State who are right-wing extremists. There's probably a couple, and we've had a couple. Matt Shea was a former state lawmaker who was up to some seriously shady stuff, and you know, when it comes to right-wing extremism and ties and stuff. But to do that, it just reeks of desperation because you're worried about losing the midterm. You want to vilify the other party, but are you doing so at the expense of the safety of people who serve the state, who haven't done anything wrong? And so it's just, I think, indicative of the sad state of politics, the sad state of the media. Like I told Representative Barkas, I hope this isn't a case of political extremism. I hope we find out. I mean, it's still bad, right? But I hope we find out it's like two idiots who thought this was a good distraction to knock off an antique store and didn't see his name on this list and decide to do something about it. But this whole situation is just really shitty. And honestly, I think shame on anyone who elevated this list of names of extremists without really taking care or concern and not weighing the consequences of it. The 2022 midterms appear to be shaping up just as Republicans hoped they would and as Democrats hoped they wouldn't. We're going to get to some really shocking results in a Texas congressional race that could spell disaster for Democrats. But there was an interesting campaign ad that aired in Washington state. So if you're not familiar, Washington's a blue state. Our senior senator is Senator Patty Murray, who has been a senator for our state for decades. Now, up until now, there really hasn't been any concern, I think, in the last couple years that there would be anyone to take Senator Patty Murray out. Well, now Senator Murray is out with a hit piece on her Republican opponent, a woman named Tiffany Smiley. Here it is.
What's at risk voting for Mitch McConnell's handpicked candidate for Senate, Tiffany Smiley? Everything.
I met with President Trump and I was so impressed.
Risking our democracy since Tiffany Smiley still has serious questions about the 2020 elections. Risking women's reproductive health care.
I am 100% pro-life.
Putting Social Security and Medicare at risk. And Mitch McConnell as majority leader. Tiffany Smiley, the wrong choice for Washington.
I'm Patty Murray and I approve this message.
So of course this leads to questions. Are Democrats so terrified of what's going to happen in the midterms that even Senator Patty Murray, a popular senator among Democrats, a stalwart of the Senate, that even she is getting worried that she might lose her Senate seat in a blue state like Washington? Joining us to discuss is Sandeep Kaushik, full of common sense, co-host of the Seattle Nice podcast and a Democratic political consultant who's helped many a Democrat get elected. Sandeep, thanks for being here.
Happy to be here.
What do you think? Is Patty Murray getting desperate? She worried?
I think she's smart. I think she's being very, very smart. Look, I don't think it's any secret that this is shaping up to be what looks like a very bad year for Democrats overall. I think that same reality is true in Washington state. It's almost, I think, unthinkable given what, Patty Murray's longevity in the state and you know, her stature and authority in Washington, D.C. But I think this is a bad enough year that even Patty Murray cannot take her reelection for granted. And complacency is exactly the kind of thing that could lead to a very unpleasant surprise. So I think I think it's an aggressive, smart campaign move to get out there and define her opponent before opponent has a chance to define herself. And let's face it, Washington State is a blue state. I think it's a bad enough year that maybe there's an outside chance that a moderate Republican could pull off a surprise upset against Patty Murray this November, but a Trump Republican who's 100%, you know, anti-choice and, you know, is praising Trump to the heavens, you know, which is what Patty Murray's ad is all about defining Tiffany Smiley. That's a pretty hard sell in Washington state. And I have only praise for what Patty's doing here. It's a smart campaign.
Do you think the ad is fair, the whole Mitch McConnell's hand-picked candidate? And I've spoken in total transparency. I've spoken at some of the same events as Tiffany Smiley. I've introduced her. I haven't endorsed anybody, obviously, but I've introduced her. She never talks about Trump. You know, that's not something she's out like you have some pro-Trump candidates who they're all about tying themselves to the former president. She talks about issues. She doesn't talk about Trump. So do you think the ad is fair?
It's totally fair. Look, Tiffany Smiley's not a dummy. If she's running around talking about Trump all day, her campaign's not going to go anywhere in Washington state. But look, totally fair. They have a quote of her gushing about how she met Trump and it was so great. You know, sorry, man. You know, you say crap like that, people are going to use it against you, and they should use it against you. It'd be campaign malpractice not to use it against her. Trump is a toxic brand in Washington State. She apparently likes the dude quite a bit, right? You know, I mean, I found that ad pretty convincing, right? If you wanna discredit her as a viable political candidate in Washington State, I thought that ad did a pretty good job of it. You know, the Mitch McConnell stuff. Mitch McConnell's a bit of a boogeyman for Democrats, mm-hmm. right? Generally, I think not without reason, and so they're playing that card there. But I think the two things about that ad that really jumped out at me were, one, going right at her for being 100% anti-choice, and two, her gushy comment about Trump.
A couple things there, and I think it's interesting. And I was the first one to do an interview with Tiffany Smiley, and I asked her about the fact that about 2 years ago, maybe a little more than that, she posted smiling pictures next to Patty Murray, thanking Senator Patty Murray for the work that she did helping veterans in Washington families. And so Tiffany Smiley has gushed about Trump, sure, but she's also gushed about Patty Murray. And I actually thought that might be more effective to use that against her to say, you know, she's out there saying that Patty Murray's not working for Washington families, yet here she is saying the exact opposite a few years earlier.
Well, I think you're putting your finger on, I think this is why Republicans have such a problem in Washington State generally, right? That they have a real, I think the National Republican Party has a real kind of brand identity problem. But if you're a Republican candidate running statewide, like Smiley is, you've got to, on the one hand, cater to your base, which is pretty rabid. And on the other hand, you've got to kind of figure out how you can get past that base, which won't get you anywhere close to getting elected, and kind of broaden out your appeal. And, you know, so running a Democratic campaign in Washington State, I think that the job on the Democratic side is to point out that, you know, she's pretty beholden to her base, or certainly shares a lot of the views of that Republican base that a lot of Washington State voters just don't agree with. Look, I mean, to the extent, if I'm Tiffany Smiley, I want this race to be entirely a referendum on not just Patty Murray, but on Joe Biden and the Democratic Party nationally. And we've talked about this before, Brandy, that I think the Democrats have a branding problem too, a growing one. And so if she can do that, she's got a shot at winning. But if they can define her and attach her to the toxicity of the National Republican brand, then Patty will kill her in a blue state.
Yeah, I mean, that's always a strategy. And even if you have a Republican who is very much not in line with former President Donald Trump, it's always been, for the last couple of years, a strategy of the Washington State Democratic Party to tie them to Trump in some way, because they know how toxic it is. But I guess just a kind of a broad takeaway, I guess I just feel like it's wild that you have someone like Patty Murray, who 2 years, you never would have guessed that there'd be anyone who there would even be a thought that they could beat her. I mean, is it reasonable to think that Patty Murray might actually lose?
I think it's unlikely, but I think it's absolutely reasonable for the Patty Murray campaign to not take her reelection for granted. Look, it's bad out there. The overall environment, all the polling that I see, either in Washington State or nationally, it's bad for the Democratic side. It looks like the congressional elections are not going to be pretty for my side. And I think that's true. That's true in Washington State as well. Pretty quickly, once you get outside the borders of Seattle, right? Even in the outer parts of King County, that in ordinary years are pretty blue, I think in some of those swingier districts around the state that often just go Democratic by default, I don't think that's true this year. So. And talk about Pierce and Snohomish County and the Central Puget Sound, which are, you know, ostensibly blue counties. So anyway, it's a bad enough year that we could see major legislative losses. We could see losing congressional seats in Washington State. And so I think Patty Murray and her team is very aware of the political environment, and you know, they're not taking anything for granted, and they should.
They don't want to risk it. On that topic, will you stick around? We'll do a little rapid fire in a couple things. Is that all right?
Cool.
I need your perspective. down in Texas, this is fascinating to me. Republican Myra Flores, who is She is a Trump supporter. She like won't even acknowledge whether the election was stolen, vehemently pro-life. This is a district where there's a special election. And it has been a Democratic district for decades. And it's believed to be, if not the most, one of the most heavy, densely populated Hispanic districts, congressional districts in the entire country. It was just won, the special election, by Myra Flores, who is a Mexican immigrant. She is married to a Border Patrol agent. What do you make of this? And she didn't just win. She won by quite a bit. 51% of the vote. The leading Democrat got 43%.
Yeah, it's I don't think it's, it's interesting that in this kind of, you know, border South Texas district that Biden won, that Democrats have won consistently, that that a Latino Republican would win. But if it was isolated that district, it's like, okay, that's an interesting, surprising result. The problem here, or at least the potential problem here, is that it's a bellwether of a larger shift that's going on with significant elements of the Latino voting base, not just in the border South in Texas, but in places in Florida and in other states. And I think this is something that some smarter Democratic strategists have been ringing an alarm bell for a while now. We saw signs in the 2020 results, even as Trump lost, that he was making some inroads with Latino voters. And I think the real issue here is this goes at what I was saying about there being a Democratic Party branding problem. But to the extent that the Democratic Party is increasingly associated with a kind of cosmopolitan cultural worldview of sort of educated progressives in cities like Seattle, right? If you know, a lot of Latino voters are working class, non-college educated, and culturally pretty traditional, you know, mm-hmm. want to have a beer and watch a football game and think we should have, you know, border security and, and on down the line, you know, religious, you know, and so on and so forth. So a lot of this cultural cosmopolitan stuff, to the extent it's really becoming integral to the Democratic brand, is, I think, culturally alienating for a lot of those voters and pushing them in a direction where Republicans seem to be now showing signs of making inroads. It's very early yet. We'll see how this trend develops. But it's a big red flag for the Democratic Party. If we, they're the Latinos are the fastest growing demographic group in the country. They're a major voting bloc in key swing states around the country. And if they start moving really significantly away from the Democratic Party, that's a very, very bad sign.
Yeah, and she said when she won and declared victory on Tuesday, for over 100 years, we have been taken for granted. Any doubt in your mind, Democrats have taken Latino voters for granted?
I don't know that they've, maybe to some extent, I think it's not quite that they've taken them for granted. It's that a lot of kind of clueless, particularly white progressive Democratic politicians sort of misunderstand what Latino voters actually want and what they, you know, what they care about. So there's this kind of assumption that, oh, if we say Latinx and, you know, and talk about, you know, quote unquote, open borders, nobody really talks about open borders, but, you know, decriminalizing border crossing, say, that's the way to get Latino voters to support the Democratic Party. And that's a major, major misread of where a lot of those voters are culturally and politically, and so it's a kind of indication that there's a certain amount of kind of cluelessness among Democratic Party elites sometimes, where they're living in a little bit of a bubble where, boy, in Seattle, we think we really know what Latino voters, you know, in Texas and Florida and Nevada really want. And guess what? It turns out maybe we don't, and we need to kind of rethink some of that.
Really, I wasn't planning to talk to you about this, but because you brought up cluelessness, am I the only one who thinks that Biden has completely lacked self-awareness on the economic challenges right now? I mean, I know he doesn't run his own Twitter account, but he's talking about I mean, nonstop. This is a tweet yesterday. Ask yourself, how well are you going to sleep at night knowing that every 5 years, Ted Cruz and other congressional Republicans pushing ultra mega policies are going to vote on whether you'll have Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid? That's their plan. And it's like, things are bad right now, and they're getting worse. And at every juncture, he's sort of distancing himself from it, as opposed to saying, look, I'm the president. No matter what, this falls on me, and I'm going to fix it. Is the president being tone deaf?
Well, I think that Team Biden's kind of been all over the map on some of this stuff. I think the president is doing some things to acknowledge the pain that voters are feeling related to things like inflation and which is, I think, the number one issue right now. Every time someone goes to fill their gas, you know, that goes to the gas pump to fill up their car, you know, there's a sense of sticker shock and a feeling like things are off in the wrong direction. I do think Biden is doing some things to acknowledge that. My criticism of Team Biden that I've made publicly for a while now is that they too misunderstood what got him elected president in the first place. And for them to be putting out tweets like that, that make him look like just another inside the beltway kind of hyper partisan politician is a huge turnoff for the kind of swath of voters who picked him over Trump, but aren't necessarily, you know, ideologically left, you know, movement left progressives, right? And his brand should have been always about kind of rising above the fray, being a sort of, you know, a statesman and somebody that was sort of trying to reach across divides and bring people together. And the more they do that, I think the better it is for Biden. You can leave the political hit stuff to the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee. There are plenty of Democrats and Democratic organizations that can do the, you know, the dirty shiv work of politics. It shouldn't be Biden doing it himself. That's just bad for his identity and his brand. And they don't seem to get that. And that's been part of the reason I think his approval ratings have been plummeting.
Yeah, and it's so contrary to who he's been for the vast majority, and you've written about this, of his political career, you know, leaning toward a moderate Democrat, and then all of a sudden he becomes president, and he just goes off the deep end with trying to please the left wing of his party. It's so odd to me, and I just don't know that his team is serving him very well right now.
Yeah.
One quick thing, just a couple of headlines that grabbed my attention. So we had the, and I know you're very interested in this, we had the recall of the uber left wing prosecutor, soft on crime prosecutor in California. There's more conversations about the LA district attorney, Gascon. And then Ted Wheeler, the mayor of Portland, who went totally fringy during 2020, is now banning homeless encampments near highways. He had a state of emergency around like trash and graffiti. What are we seeing happening on the West Coast? What is this shift?
Yeah, there's a recalibration going on from progressive politicians. I don't think there's any question about that. It's not 2020 anymore in Portland or Seattle or San Francisco or LA or these West Coast cities where politicians sort of in the fervor of that moment in the summer of 2020 with the intensity of the George Floyd protests, with the kind of restrictions created by COVID, with the presidential election and kind of Trump and everybody's face in places around here, you know, as a kind of, you know, toxic presence in everybody's face. I think that those factors drove a lot of progressive politicians into the arms of activists advocating ideas like defund and abolition of the criminal justice system and, you know, some pretty radical stuff. And even taking, I think, what are good ideas around reform of these systems and pushing those ideas past the breaking point to where you've got somebody like the San Francisco DA essentially sending everyone, regardless of their criminal histories, their felony histories, their histories of violent crime, into alternatives to incarceration rather than the, you know, criminal justice prosecutorial system with disastrous results, right? I mean, these people then, diversion is a good thing in a lot of cases, but you've got to do that triage and figure out who's somebody who is going to be more helped by sending them to an alternative, as opposed to somebody who needs to, you know, get prosecuted and go to jail. And he wasn't doing it. And guess what? Then you have this sort of release first mentality where people who are committing significant crimes and causing real disruptions to the social fabric and the social order in San Francisco were being released, you know, over and over to commit crimes, which is again, a problem we have in Seattle as well right now. Some of this stuff has just gone too far. And I think there is a recalibration going on. Look, Portland to me is kind of a cautionary tale for Seattle, because as crappy as things may be in Seattle, and I know people think things are on the wrong track here, Portland is worse, right? Their encampment problem was worse than in Seattle. Their downtown is still more boarded up and messed up than downtown Seattle is. Their trash problem was worse. And their politicians were even more feckless, right? You know,
if that's possible.
I think it was. Ted Wheeler was kind of embarrassing for a long time there, and didn't have any sense of kind of self and what he believed. He was just a kind of weather vane in the wind. And so now you're seeing a retrenchment going on from people like Ted Wheeler. And it's because public dissatisfaction with the state of the city of Portland is off the charts. The polling is really, really grim there, to the point that they're getting close to a kind of quote unquote Giuliani time sort of backlash from the voters, who are just seeing things go to hell, right? And so I do think, yeah, I think what Wheeler's doing around encampment cleanups and the other politicians, I think the interesting race to watch there is the Portland City Council race with Joanne Hardesty, who was the African-American City Council member who kind of led the charge on defund in Portland, is now facing a challenge from a candidate who's running on a much more of a kind of law and order kind of platform, to borrow the phrase. But that's going to be an interesting race to watch and see how it plays out.
Well, and I'll end with this, because it brings me to the question, you know, for these politicians who, you know, they're completely changing their tune or starting to change their tune from what they did to their respective cities and states in 2020. Is it a genuine change of course because they realize they were wrong, or is it to save their ass for an election?
Well, I think it's a little bit of both that's going on. You know, I mean, these people are politicians. Look, they should be responding to public sentiment, right? I mean, that's part of your job as an elected official. And if you come to the realization, hey, maybe I got too far out over my skis on something and misread where my voters or my constituents really want me to be, then, you know, good for them. They should recalibrate on that stuff. I mean, I actually think they're not recalibrating fast enough on some of this stuff. Their problem is some of them are still in denial a little bit about how frustrated the public is in cities like Seattle around things like street disorder and crime and feeling unsafe and, you know, all of that sort of stuff. And still sort of pushing ideas that are sort of at least still vaguely aligned with the kind of, you know, defund mantra, right?
Yeah, you and I both talked about they're still pushing some of these activists to defund the sexual assault unit in Seattle, the unit that investigates rapes, child rapes. It's like,
well, I know, right? I mean, I know you were in the middle of this kerfuffle on Twitter with any number of people and The Stranger and some other journalists at the Seattle Times and KUOW, and they all did seem to me to be ignoring the elephant in the room, which is not just that, hey, guess what? If you're gonna see a massive attrition at SVD, where we're down about 400 officers from where we need to be, where we should be, full staffing, that guess what? If you're Chief Diaz, you're gonna have to pull people off the specialty units to just man the precincts to deal with 911 calls and, you know, stuff like that. And that's an inevitable consequence generally of defund. But even more than that, this was a specific call from the defund activists, right? They particularly wanted the sexual assault unit to be defunded by 50% and the money repurposed to giving money to victims and, you know, some other stuff that I think I would like to see some more, you know, investments made on that side. But they specifically, this is not a bug, it's a feature of what they were calling for. They don't trust SPD to investigate sex crimes. So I think it's a little embarrassing that some of these other folks in the media aren't willing to acknowledge the plain reality of what the defunders were actually very directly and explicitly calling for. As this, their solidarity budget came out in September of last year, right before the city's budget process for 2022. And they're right out in the open saying this is what they want to see happen. Well, guess what? It happened for whatever reason. So now why are we sort of all of a sudden the same people that supported defund are now scrambling to say, oh, well, how did this happen? This is terrible, right?
I'm blaming the police because that's who, of course, that's who they're going to blame. But it is troubling. You know, if it was just The Stranger, which for people who aren't familiar is the Alt Weekly in Seattle, then fine. You know, we know what The Stranger is. We know what it's about. But when you've got the newspaper of record in the city that is really failing to try to hold people accountable for why we have so many officers that have left the city, that becomes problematic because that's really influencing public opinion in a serious way.
To some extent, I mean, I did think the framing of that original story was interesting, right? Because the authors, and it was a joint effort from KUOW and the Seattle Times. But the clear framing of that story, the authors of that story wanted to make it about this is a choice that SPD is making, and you know and they made it very explicit that it's about they'd rather fund SPD officers staffing encampment cleanups than investigating sex crimes. That was the sort of kind of pretty upfront theme of that story. But you know what? I think most voters in Seattle, progressive voters, right, read that story, and you know, I think they immediately get that it's related to the fact that SPD is way, way, way understaffed. I mean, voters aren't stupid, right? And so they can frame the stories however they want, but I think the general consensus is that, yeah, the fact that we're down to 900 officers rather than 1,300 officers is probably a pretty significant factor in why we're not able to investigate sexual assaults the way I think most of us agree we ought to be investigating, right?
Exactly.
And so I'm kind of like, they can frame the story how they want, but they can't really, you know, I hesitate to use this term, but I think the left does this a lot. I'm not saying this particularly about the journalist who wrote that story, but there's a lot of gaslighting that goes on from the kind of movement left or progressive left in Seattle on things like crime and defund and stuff. And I think just to be fair, if you're going to be a journalist, you ought to be covering that as well as, you know, questionable decisions maybe made by SPD brass. Like, I think just in the interest of context and completeness, you ought to be doing that. And I think we see that less and less from some of these journalistic organs these days. They seem to frame stories in a very particular way based on ideological commitments. Right?
Yes, they do. Yes, they do. You know, but when I point that out, what did I get called? Right-wing and unhinged?
Yeah,
and Sandeep, I bet they won't call you right-wing and unhinged. I wonder why.
Well, you know, we'll see. I may get called right-wing and unhinged.
All right. Well, Sandeep Kaushik, I always enjoy to have you on. Appreciate your common sense approach to really talking about your own party. It's quite refreshing. So thank you for being here.
Fun talking with you, Brandy. Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So we'll see what happens. There are a lot of indicators that the midterms aren't going to be good for Democrats. You know, I know that there's the abortion debate happening, the issue around mass shootings in this country, that Democrats are trying to focus on those issues so that it distracts from other things like the economy and public safety. But, you know, Sandeep, like I said, he's helped a lot of moderate Democrats win office, and he doesn't seem too optimistic about what's going to happen for Democrats in November. But honestly, as someone who thinks balance is a good thing, I don't think it's going to be a bad thing if we've got some Republican seats back to try to push through some more common sense issues as it pertains to public safety, et cetera. So we will see what happens. All right, coming up next, and on the issue of public safety, if you guys recall, a couple weeks ago, I had you submit ideas to help prevent mass shootings in this country, but they had to be ideas that could get bipartisan support. So hundreds of you sent in ideas, and I picked seven of them, including one of my own, honestly, that we ran by a panel of five experts, and experts from different ends of the political spectrum and different areas of expertise. So here are our five experts. Emily Cantrell, who's a gun responsibility advocate. She also survived the Las Vegas shooting. Dave Workman, he is a Second Amendment advocate, editor-in-chief of thegunmag.com. Jeffrey Slotnick, he's a security expert, president of Cetricon Inc., and Senator Joe Wynn, Democratic lawmaker in Washington State, as well as Representative Chris Corey, a Republican lawmaker in Washington State. So we want to get a variety of different opinions, and I want to go through a couple of the ideas that they agreed had some potential, at least, to prevent mass shootings. So what we did is they gave them a rating 1 to 5 based on how effective the idea would be to prevent mass shootings. And then we added those numbers up and took the average. And so anything above 3 and over, basically our panel on the whole decided that it was an idea that had at least some potential to prevent mass shootings. One of them was the idea of mandatory minimum sentences of 10 years in prison for any felony committed with a firearm, 15 years for a second offense, life in prison for a third offense. So this certainly speaks more to the mass shootings when it's like a gang member, for instance. And our definition of mass shooting here is as follows: a single act of violence during which 4 or more people sustain gunshot wounds. So certainly if you have someone who's like a gang member or something, and they use their guns to commit a crime and they're heading to prison, then that could prevent some sort of mass shooting down the road. And so here's what a couple of our experts said. Emily Cantrell, again, a shooting survivor, she said the idea was a 2. She didn't love the idea. She said, "Well, I do believe this idea would help reduce overall gun violence. I'm not confident it would help prevent mass shootings, as the majority of mass shooters die in their own attacks." Now, Jeff Slotnick, the security expert, he gave the idea a 4, but he also acknowledged that it might not prevent what I think the public and members of the media consider like a traditional mass shooting. He wrote, "Although some shootings may be prevented by this, many shooters have already decided to end their lives and are not concerned with post-event consequences." All right, another idea that got over a 3 on average from our experts is the idea of a 15-day waiting period for gun buyers who are aged 18 to 25. So just the youngest gun buyers. Senator Chris Corey, he rated the idea a 2. And his argument was basically, "Look, I support reasonable waiting periods, which are already in place in Washington State," because he thinks they prevent, you know, suicides or domestic violence, homicides. But he said, you know, in a lot of these shootings that involve young people, they get the gun or they steal the gun from a family member. So he doesn't think a waiting period would have been effective. State Senator Joe Wynn, he rated the idea a 5. Loved the idea. He said, "Alan Ivanov, who carried out a mass shooting when he was 19 years old in Seattle, testified that a factor in him being able to carry out the attack was the ease to obtain a weapon." Some of the other ideas that they looked at that did not rate very high: a nationwide gun registration database, requiring schools to utilize metal detectors, mandatory 8-hour gun safety classes before you buy your first firearm, age-appropriate gun safety education in schools. I thought that was interesting. So this idea from an undivided subscriber would call for age-appropriate gun safety education in schools, grades 3 through 12, and the parents could opt out. Emily Cantrell gave the idea a 3, saying, "America has long glorified gun violence in video games and movies. If we change the culture around gun ownership and start gun safety education at an early age, this could help prevent mass shootings." Jeff Slotnick, the security expert, wrote, and he rated the idea a 3. He wrote, "I do feel there should be more focus on empowering children to identify indicators of violence and developing an anonymous reporting mechanism when they identify potentially violent behaviors." So those were just some of the ideas. There was another idea about a nationwide firearm buyback to get illicit guns off the street, but it did not do very well. Dave Workman, again, editor-in-chief of thegunmag.com, called the idea a 1, although he told me he wanted to give it a negative rating. He said mass shooters planning an event are simply not going to sell their gun. So it's challenging to find bipartisan agreement on really anything related to the gun debate, which is why I was really surprised and pleasantly surprised to hear that there is a bipartisan proposal going through Congress right now that has the potential to pass. Now, it's not really what Democrats want when it comes to restricting access to firearms, but a lot of it focuses on mental health and well-being of people in this country, which I think is a really good idea. I mean, that's kind of a no-brainer. And so we'll see what comes out of Congress. But the fact that they're, you know, you always hear, do something, do something. And if you don't do anything at all, then nothing will change. And so if they can find some bipartisan agreement to, quote unquote, do something, then I think that's, I don't think that's a bad thing. And so we will see what Congress ultimately ends up with. All right, I want to end by talking, since we're on the subject of school shootings, about the current investigation into the mass shooting in Uvalde, Texas. I have been very clear that I believe the police response was bungled, that I believe it was completely unacceptable, the fact that you had officers who waited outside that classroom for such a long period of time. And now, there's another wrinkle to this that really makes me question what's happening with that police department down there. And as you guys know, I'm very supportive of law enforcement. So you know that when I am being critical of them, that they did something bad. So there are understandably members of the public and members of the press who are trying to get their hands on the body camera footage of the police response. But the Texas Department of Public Safety is trying to block release of that footage to the public. And they say that it could expose, quote, weakness in the law enforcement response. Obviously, when you have body camera footage, the public can get access to it. It's a public record. There are laws that dictate that. There are laws surrounding it. And I would say, as a member of the press, there is some of that body camera footage that you wouldn't air. I mean, obviously, some of it's going to be incredibly disturbing. Now, it's not unusual for the press to get all of the footage from some horrific event and then use their judgment to decide what to show and to not show on TV. But what the body camera footage most certainly could do is help clear up the timeline of the police response in Uvalde. And that might be the only thing, in fact, that could truly clear up the timeline. I mean, I don't really trust anything coming out of officials in Texas because there have been so many mistruths that have been told up to this point. And so the Texas Attorney General, Ken Paxton, he is going to respond to this request to suppress the body camera footage by reviewing the audio and the video and determining himself whether any of it can be released. He also said that it's possible that you could release still images, essentially, in lieu of releasing, you know, an entire video or something. But the Texas Department of Public Safety is arguing, and I'll read this quote from Vice, "Revealing the marked records would provide criminals with invaluable information concerning department techniques used to investigate and detect activities of suspected criminal elements, how information is assessed and analyzed, how information is shared among partner law enforcement agencies, and the lessons learned from the analysis of prior criminal activities." So basically they're saying, look, if you get your hands on this body camera footage, then criminals are going to know how we do things and how we operate, and they're going to use that against us. And that's possible. You know, when there are riots, for instance, in Seattle or planned protests in Seattle, the police department will not release an exact number of how many officers are going to be out and where they're going to be because they don't want to clue the ne'er-do-wells off to anything. And to me, that's understandable. But in an instance like this, you know, they're worried that it'll hurt their ability to respond to other incidents because criminals will have a one-up on them. Well, look how you responded to this incident. I mean, I don't think it could have gotten much worse. And so, you know, you're worried it'll expose weaknesses in law enforcement. Your whole response was a weakness. And I believe the public has a right to know and to have a clear picture of the timeline. So I hope that the Texas Attorney General feels the same way and that they don't block the release of this footage because I think you have a community that is already deeply upset, disturbed, sad, troubled, angry with police, and blocking that footage is not going to make the situation any better. It'd just be silly. And, you know, I got tipped off to this story because I got a message from Spike Cohen. Spike Cohen is the Libertarian, or was the Libertarian candidate for vice president. He and I had sat down for an interview a few months ago. And during that interview, I asked him about the Libertarian stance on defunding and law enforcement. And he kind of paused when I asked whether policing was a noble profession. And I got down on him for pausing because to me, of course, policing is a noble profession. But he sent me this article about what's happening in Uvalde. And he said, "Hi, Brandy, remember when you asked me if I thought policing was a noble profession? And I paused. These are the kind of things that popped into my head when you asked that." He said, "I think people typically join the police for noble reasons, just like I think people become public school teachers for noble reasons, but I think those actual institutions fail at their stated goals and instead become ghastly caricatures of what we actually wanted them to be." He said, "I hope that explanation makes sense." And look, I still do believe very much so that policing is a noble profession. And there have been shootings where the law enforcement response has been nothing short of brave. And what happened in Texas clearly is not that. We need to get to the bottom of it. The body camera footage can help us do that. And so I appreciate Spike Cohen following up with me and giving an example of why he paused when I asked that question. And there are a lot of reasons to pause when it comes to what happened in Uvalde. So hopefully Texas, the state of Texas, does not make things worse by preventing the public from getting answers. That's it for the first episode of Undivided from our new studio, a new expanded podcast lineup. Remember, the Wednesday podcast will be exclusive to subscribers only starting next week. You can get access to it on Patreon or Locals. And if you don't want to watch it via video, it is also posted simply as a podcast if you prefer that. If you do want to get access to the Wednesday exclusive episode that is ad-free, you can do that by becoming a subscriber on my Patreon or Locals community, patreon.com/undivided or brandycruz.locals.com. And in fact, on Locals right now, we're offering 3 free months for a yearly subscription. So now is a really great time to take advantage of that. As always, thank you for your commitment to giving common sense a comeback.